we very quickly become defensive of a single idea that we've been working in. And as much as we don't think we're doing it or we think we're staying open-minded, we're simply not. By far, exploring multiple ideas in parallel is vastly more effective. And actually, teams that move forward in that idea are actually almost 50% more likely to have a successful launch.
Welcome to the IDOU Creative Confidence Podcast, a series focused on building your confidence at work to tackle your biggest creative challenges.
Join us as we learn insights and lessons straight from IDEO and today's most impact-oriented design thinking leaders.
Hi, I'm Suzanne Gibbs Howard.
And I'm Kalita Stafford.
Welcome to another one of our Creative Confidence series. I'm Suzanne Gibbs Howard, and I'm here today with David Aiken.
Hi, thanks for having me, Suze.
Yeah. Today's conversation is about measuring creativity and innovation and learning different ways that you can use those metrics and assessments to figure out where your team and organization want to build and practice. And so David's with us today. He is both an engineer and has an MBA. He's worked in lots of different businesses and uses entrepreneurial ventures as a form of a creative act. So he's been at IDEO. He had his own skateboard company, which expanded to Japan from all around the US and Canada. He's also run a couple different startups here in Silicon Valley. And currently at IDEO is leading a few different products and tools that we're creating to help organizations and teams scale their own creativity, and one of those is called Creative Difference. So today we'll talk a little bit about what he's learning through that. I'm glad you're here.
Thank you.
What I wanted to do was start off asking you how we can measure something like creativity when it's such a ephemeral kind of a thing.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of myths around creativity, and I mean, there's definitely the sort of the mystery aspect to it. But there's definitely what we call kind of the teenager phenomenon about it, like this sort of, oh, we're all different. We do it our own way. There's no way to measure it. And that is definitely a myth. I mean, we've seen that that's not true. There are fundamental qualities that are needed in any environment and that can consistently allow teams to be better creative problem solvers. And with Creative Difference, we're able to kind of measure and prove some of those.
And how did you land on what the qualities even are? What did you do to figure out what the common things?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, we went on, you know, a pretty robust study to try to figure out what the factors were that we really could sort of back with data and encourage organizations to actually build out with data. I mean, we started out with, you know, what IDEO has kind of been practicing for a long time. And we, you know, IDEO has obviously been innovating for about 40 years now in one form or another. And, you know, for 10, 20 years, we've been talking a lot about, you know, what it takes and sharing our practices with the world. And we've been doing that through subjective means and the fact that we've just experienced a lot. And to us, it's very intuitive and it makes sense. But things like, you know, having a purpose-driven goal or, spending time with customers and having user-centered design. We basically looked at, well, how would you tell if an organization is actually doing those things or if they have the practices to do them? So we turned all those into factors that you could, you know, measure and observe in an environment. So we started there, and we also expanded that to look at academic studies on creativity and innovation, added any factors that we were missing from our stuff there. And then we also started to go and look through, you know, interviews with creative leaders and CEOs, you know, the Elon Musks and others of the world, mm-hmm. Jeff Bezos, and see, well, what are they accounting to their organization's ability to sort of innovate? So once we had this sort of set of factors, we went around basically, you know, measuring them and going to dozens and then hundreds of organizations and getting them to participate and you know, start with the version one of Creative Difference. Wow. To say, well, you know, which of these do we do and to what degree, and what degree of success are they having based on those in terms of successful projects, successful launches, new ventures launched, yeah, et cetera. And we saw that, yeah, I mean, creativity is predictable. You can set up in success in ways that can be measured. And that was the start of the Creative Difference framework.
Wow, I love that creativity can be predictable. And so if you say, now you've studied, you've implemented this survey and this assessment across something like 600 plus different companies. Mm-hmm. What I'd love for you to do is to walk us through the six different qualities that you think about. I want to introduce them to our community. And while we do this, have people think a little bit about, in their own personal organization, where are they a little stronger and what might they have to work on?
Sure. Yeah. Well, so once we had identified these factors, we rolled them up into these six qualities. And they're in sequence, in the sequence that I'll present them in, for a reason, because they do actually kind of like build off of each other in an order, in a sense. The first is purpose. And it's basically, it's really hard to, you know, do any kind of innovation or driving of change without a purpose, because you need that sort of direction to set people off and to get the gears turning and pulling them in a direction. I think we're going to talk more about that one in some detail later. The next is looking out. So, you know, I think we all know, anyone working in an organization of some size, is there's a lot of pressures to turn your gaze like inwards, dealing with the day-to-day, your peers, political pressures, other things. It's hard to make time to look outside of your company, but that's such an important factor. So, you know, once you know where you're heading with your purpose, you've got to actually start, you know, looking out there at what people are doing, what technologies are available, how that market is evolving, and really making, you know, systematically going out there and looking out. The next creative quality is experimentation. So what we see is, once organizations do start looking out, they get a lot of ideas. It sort of starts triggering the intuition of like what might work. And that becomes kind of an intimidating moment for a lot of organizations. They're like, how do we deal with all of this stuff? Everyone's got these ideas. We couldn't possibly explore all the ideas. Well, being good at experimentation allows you to actually, in a low-cost way, start turning all that intuition into evidence and invest in those ideas that actually prove some merit. And so we see experimentation as sort of linking up and creating a healthy pipeline of innovation, where organizations can explore many different ideas in quick and dirty ways, and then invest in more rigorous experimentation until they're able to launch to market. And essentially being a learning organization.
Yeah, great. So purpose, looking out, experimentation, yep. And what falls after that?
After that, it's collaboration. It's sort of breaking the silos, getting people working together in productive ways across different types of functions. So just ensuring that you have the diversity of talent and expertise to bring to bear on these challenges, and then that they're actually able to find each other and work together effectively. Mm-hmm. The next big one is empowerment. You know, a lot of people, you know, we're coming out of an era where innovation was very specialized, very specific teams. We're seeing more and more is that organizations actually empower larger proportions, if not all of their organization, mm-hmm. to be creative problem solvers. So they're helping people take ownership of certain parts of the scope of innovation. They're giving people the tools and the mindset to actually think in new ways and creative problem solve. And, you know, IDEO-U is kind of a way that is scaled in organizations.
And both large and small ways. So they could be big efforts and it could be just micro.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, really enlightened organizations extend this to their operations teams, their finance teams, you know, like the way that they're thinking about improving and modernizing their systems. Mm-hmm. And then finally is refinement. It's really about achieving excellence, keeping the vision of new ideas through execution, and making the time to create a problem solve to come up with truly elegant solutions.
Wow. So from beginning to end, that's an amazing set of qualities. And what I love about that is that it takes you from like the most seemingly abstract parts of leadership, like what are the big ideas with the purpose, all the way through to the fact that if you're not delivering something all the way to the market, nobody's going to follow along and stay with this. And I'm curious with that, like, what are some of the big ahas that you've had now that you've taken something that was kind of amorphous and now you're measuring it and you're constantly collecting treasure troves of data on this? What have been some of your surprises with you and your team?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of them. And it's because it's been nice that creative difference in some ways has like validated a lot of the things that we talked about. And there are always these sort of surprising things that pop up and make you think, but then kind of make sense once you've been able to kind of digest them. I mean, one I thought was really fascinating, we got challenged with about, you know, a year and a half ago, as we were, you know, talking with a large automobile company about some of these things. And they're like, oh, you know, I understand, you know, coming from Silicon Valley, all this experimentation and stuff is sort of the way of software, but does this actually apply to, you know, a big automobile company with a really long cycle? Like, how do you do quick and dirty prototyping, and does it matter? And So we kind of went back into our data and we had a number of like manufacturing companies and others with sort of long product life cycles. And we looked at the data and we were like, wow, it actually matters a lot more to those types of organizations. You know, it, yeah, it matters and it works in software, but in software with the launch and learn mentality, you know, you, if you don't prototype, you can still iterate. And so
it's harder to do.
It's a lot harder to do with the cars. But you know, we've seen a lot of organizations, you know, Toyota and others that have like managed to do really lightweight experimentation early on and iterate before they start entering these massive life cycles. And so what we actually see is that with when we took a bucket of the long life cycle products compared to those with the shorter life cycle, for the long life cycle, it actually matters like four times more.
Wow.
So it actually improves the likelihood of a successful launch by four times or a successful wow. product launch by four times.
Amazing. So trying to figure out how to do those quick and dirty experiments, MVP or smaller,
yeah,
just to answer those big questions early on. So maybe if you could share a little bit then about what do you see. I mean, I think empowerment's really interesting. I think we know that traditional leadership styles were much more command and control, top down, directives and vision and mission set by the leaders. And these days we know that companies need to be more agile, more flexible. And so leaving people at all levels of the company to feel empowered to lead.
Yeah.
But how do you keep people moving in the same direction while enabling them and empowering them to be leaders in their own life?
Yeah, I mean, purpose is a huge part of directing that, right? Because it starts to create the rails of like, hey, like, here's where we're going as a bigger organization. You know, if you have good ideas for actually getting us there, we're more and open to that receptivity. So I think a big part of it is providing real clarity on sort of the strategy and the purpose that kind of set that direction. And then once people are really clear on that direction, it's easier to kind of provide the autonomy and ownership that people can have.
So those two really work in tandem.
100%. Yeah. I mean, another one is really having clear decision-making criteria, right? And again, I mean, purpose weighs into that, but there's other, you know, financial considerations, growth considerations, a number of those. And we saw the organizations that really empower people also really have a really clear, fair level playing field on how they're making those decisions. Because what really reinforces is if you're going to tell thousands of people like, hey, like you can make a difference, your idea can actually get implemented, they need to believe it. And so when they see decisions being made and they see some things getting invested in and some things not getting invested in, if they don't have a clear understanding for how those decisions were made, they lose faith really, really quickly. And that saps effort, it saps morale. And so,
can you think of a company that's doing that well, or an example that you've seen where you admire?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the tech companies do that well. I mean, Netflix does it well, Airbnb does it well. Mm-hmm. You know, they have really clear metrics that they're driving for as an organization, and they really like do let the teams be very open and empowered on what ideas they're testing. I mean, Airbnb is a cool example because they actually have a ritual where a new hire actually will launch a new feature on day one of joining the company. So it's like, hey, like, and if it, you know, they have a way of sort of A/B testing that into getting scaled up and launched with the entire product. But it sets that early on as like, you can launch something that is part of Airbnb. And if it passes, you know, the metrics and actually it helps us achieve our goals, it'll scale up into the product proper.
Nice. Well, I'd love to go a little bit into experimentation too. I know we've got one of our favorite statistics that you started to pull out of Creative Difference that we wanted to share, which is about the power of experimentation and getting more than one idea. So I want you to talk a little bit about how you started to see this coming out in your data.
Yeah, I mean, that was a fascinating one because there's so many different, you know, methods of driving forward ideas. And we've seen a few that are kind of the most common. And, you know, I'll kind of put it to the audience maybe to try to like guess which one is more effective as we go here. But, you know, kind of more traditional style is, you know, come up with some, you know, a few sensible options that, you know, make some rational sense, and then basically spend a lot of time doing your research and analyzing the effectiveness of those, and then basically like choose the option. Another one that we've been excited about, you know, lately is sort of this lean startup approach, and it kind of embraces a lot of these values of like launch and learn and, you know, get your best guess out there, build an MVP, and then iterate from there. And then another method is to kind of always be exploring multiple versions of a solution at once. So, you know, take five or more concepts that solve a given problem and evaluate them in parallel. you know, there's other permutations of these, but we sort of looked at these methods, and most organizations can kind of opt into what, into these. There's a couple others that we provide. And what we saw is by far the work exploring multiple ideas in parallel is vastly more effective. And actually teams that move forward in that idea compared to the other two are actually almost 50% more likely to have a successful launch.
What do you think it is, though, about having, because it seems like it would be kind of the opposite, that you'd get overwhelmed by handling five different ones. But what does that do for a team?
Yeah, I mean, there's a few reasons. The two main ones that we've identified is, one, there's a factor I'd say kind of poorly named called cognitive laziness. And it's not laziness in the true sense. It has more to do with how our brains are wired, which is that we very quickly become defensive of a single idea that we've been working in. And as much as we don't think we're doing it, or we think we're staying open-minded, we're simply not. And so we get embedded, we get invested, and it's really hard for us to sort of back up and see the objective truth behind that. The other is really just the quality of feedback that we get as we're exploring and building that idea. So if we have one concept that's out there and we're trying to evaluate it, right, with the lean startup method, for example, you know, people are going to be a little more positive. You know, we're social animals, so they're going to be, you know, they may be straight shooter and say a few things they don't like, but then they're going to, you know, kind of couch that with a few things they do like. Versus when you've got a number of ideas on the table, you can really see where people are being drawn to, right? And which maps to their model of how they'd like that solution solved for them. And you just get a lot better feedback.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's really nice. I think sometimes it feels like you're less invested in any one of the five, and you can't have your little concept baby.
100%.
So you can pull them against each other. I think that's really interesting to think about, like the how do we encourage teams to actually try a wider variety of things and learn from all these different angles, especially in the early stages?
Yeah.
I'm curious to hear a little bit more about purpose. So we know purpose is the critical starting place for a lot of this, but I think we see over the years, a lot of us have seen some really poorly articulated purposes or visions or missions. And so I'm curious what you've learned about what a high quality purpose statement looks like.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's three factors that we look at. So a lot of these qualities, we have sub-qualities, and there's three under purpose that we've seen is really important. The first one is basically clarity, right? It's do people understand it, and do they have a consistent view of it, right? So, I mean, I think executives or leaders, they sometimes neglect that it just doesn't stick the first time, right? Like you can't just make an annual strategy statement and be like, this is our purpose, and everyone back to work, and then they all get it. I mean, it just kind of floats away, right? So the degree to like repeat and demonstrate and storytell that purpose and help people really grasp onto what it is so important. Yeah. The second is usefulness, right? And this is the ability, like, how is the purpose made accessible for people to actually act on it? And so, you know, a lot of the time the purpose can just be too abstract, right? Like it could be a financial goal or like just make our customers happier or something. And it's like, okay, but it doesn't really provide that like concreteness and guidance that helps people actually act. So it's got to have that level of specificity. The last one is passion, which is, you know, does it actually stir something in people? Does it resonate with the reason that people are maybe at your company or why they went into their career or industry to start with.
I know, we always say, like, why do you get out of bed in the morning?
100%.
You know, it's not just to show up and follow through your tasks of the day. It has to be something
deep
in your heart.
Yeah, and that kind of lights that fire. And when you can line those three up together, you know, that really helps people just want to bring their best selves to the job and do everything that they can to achieve that purpose.
And I love the connection between the purpose and then the empowerment. So I know you had shared a few stories with me about when a purpose is articulated well, you can hold things up to it and it'll help you make decisions. And I know you mentioned like a couple companies that do this well.
Sure.
What's an example?
Yeah, I mean, there's a bunch. I think Southwest, I think, is one where, you know, they basically like baked it into everything that they do, right? So it's so easy to just that the purpose becomes like a statement on the wall and you know, we talk about it, but you know, purpose is a really fragile thing in a sense. And if you see that people aren't acting on it or it's not like baked into how things are being done, it quickly loses power. And so, you know, with Southwest, and hopefully I won't butcher this, but it's their purpose being, you know, connect people to what matters in the world through friendly air travel. Again, it, you know, it's not the most inspiring to me as a statement, but I think the fact that they live it makes it so powerful, right? So their training is all about customer satisfaction and how everyone in any role can particularly like make their flyer's journey, you know, great. And where I think this really, to me, embeds and becomes really concrete is actually through their customer support centers. And what they have is listening centers where they actually, you know, when they're dealing with these customer support requests and the right, you know, all of these always have the metrics of like, how quickly can you deal with the issues? Can you deal with them all within first touch? But for Southwest, their top metrics are actually around, is someone leaving these interactions happy? Have their problem get solved and are they actually in a better mood than when they left? And that's like their key metric driving this, right? So it's down to that level of these operational systems where they're actually, you know, measuring and saying, no, our purpose is like what each of these systems is meant to achieve. And that just makes it real for everyone. They'll actually believe it and start to act towards that purpose. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. And I love the way that you can see how somebody's micro action that they have complete and total personal control over connects back up to that bigger purpose. And that's absolutely very empowering. How do you get started small when you're working on purpose? Mm. Are there ways to set that in motion?
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, you rarely want to start from scratch with purpose, right? It's like, you know, even when it might feel like you're starting from scratch, in reality, there's almost something there. So a lot of the time, the best way is to just start gathering stories from people of like, why did they choose to work at this organization? Why did they choose to go into this field of study? Mm-hmm. You know, what are their proudest, you know, moments at the company? Like what are those moments that they wish they could recreate or that the organization could create every day that is sort of represent that organization at its best, right? Sort of starting that dialogue within the organization and, you know, starting to pull those out, or even, you know, doing like an open innovation kind of sourcing of those stories is really a great way to start to fuel and provide the input to like starting to craft a purpose that is, you know, kind of a reforming of what's already there in some ways.
Hi, Suzanne here. I just want to tell you a little bit more about IDOU. We're an online school where anyone can learn to solve anything creatively. And if you're curious to go deeper into the topics of this webcast and learn more about IDEO's tools and mindsets for organizational design, join our Designing for Change online course. Now let's get back to the conversation. How do you move beyond tokenism to real empowerment? And do you see situations where it's like this light gesture, but it's not real? And then are there ways that you see organizations are truly opening that up to deeper impact in some of the
things you work with? 6 or 7 years ago, I was working with a big tech company, and I thought they had a really great stance towards this, which is, you know, they would create these project teams to work on big, important challenges. They'd be, you know, reporting up into the executive team. And, you know, they were experimenting with this method at the time, so it was kind of new to them, but they had come out of a culture where it was very much like the executives were very directive in these meetings. They had a strong opinion and the like, but they were kind of backed up to the state where you respect that the team doing the work has the answers, that it's hard for all that to always be relayed in a timely moment, but like to always trust that the team had done the research or had the background. And so to always sort of ask questions when you're unsure rather than to dictate that something, an assumption seems off and the like. And basically what the executives also, they would, you know, reserve sort of veto rights to stop something, but at no point would they inject a new directive to any of those teams. So they could make suggestions to the team, but they would never actually like tell them what to do. And they would always start with the assumption that the team would have the right answer if asked.
Yeah.
So those types of subtle stance changes can be really important to help the team understand that they own that challenge. They're responsible for the process to get there. They're responsible for the answers. And that ultimately anything that does get implemented is going to be their idea and not the executive's idea.
Yeah, I think that's a big pattern that we've heard in all of our leadership programs and conversations, is that it all hinges around the leader's ability to control themselves and not come in and swoop in and make decisions when it's not the place to. And so that empowerment can stay steady, and one small shift from a faulty point in leadership takes all of that empowerment away.
Absolutely.
That's huge. I know one thing I wanted to touch on is refinement. Mm-hmm. I think that's one thing that you've really brought with Creative Difference even more powerfully into the definition of innovation and creative leadership, here at IDEO. Mm-hmm. And so I wish you could talk a little bit just about why that's so critical.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, absolutely. A lot of the time, a lot of the time the innovation part is thought of the sort of the early sort of solving the fuzzy problems early on. And definitely there's so many things about that that are really important, yeah, and that a lot of organizations have a lot of work to do there. But that is really only one part of it. I mean, the innovation journey has really just started. Even when you've got like a great idea that's founded in research and it's testing well, the fact that that's going to actually become like an innovative solution in the market, I mean, there's a lot of barriers left to go, right?
Yeah.
And so what we see in so many organizations is that those functions are just really like siloed off from the execution uh-huh. parts of the business. And that sort of handoff is a real like breakdown point for a lot of organizations. And so these integration points of ensuring that, you know, those sort of upfront innovators are able to help carry that vision through execution, that the implementers are actually tied in and helping think about viable solutions mm-hmm. early on and getting some ownership to carry things through, it can really help kind of smooth that handoff period. Beyond that, it's like, even the creative part is not done with a concept, right? Like
yeah.
as implementation happens, all these, you know, technical issues will pop up as you go. If you're just trying to like hammer those out as quickly as possible without consideration of the effect of the overall experience or solution or vision, what you kind of end up with something that is very different than what was originally intended.
Yeah.
And so what all these, you know, when we think of these organizations that bring really like beautiful, elegant solutions to the world, you know, like the Apples, the Teslas or others, it's mm-hmm. like, you know, they have a real focus on creative problem solving through technical execution. They identify these important consumer touch points or stakeholder touch points, and they put in the practices to refine those, to think creatively about them, you know, and that's at all stages from that sort of early fuzzy thinking through to the point where it's the product is
mm-hmm.
shipped.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. And I think so. I can see we have a couple questions about the relationship between explorers and refinement. Definitely what we mean to say is that certainly we explore as part of leading these things, but if you're not driving it all the way through and iterating your way toward premium execution.
Yeah.
It's just not, things aren't going to stick, and all of those other things lose a lot of their meaning and impact without that end game.
Absolutely.
There.
Yes.
So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how do you measure creativity? So you've got these six qualities. It is based on a survey. How
That's
do you
right.
balance, and what's your thinking about how you actually get to the metrics? How do you ask questions to understand really, really what's going on?
Yeah, I mean, that kind of comes back to some of that earlier methodology of like identifying those factors and then sort of figuring out how we, like which questions could get there and which of them actually have the most impact. I mean, a few factors are it's not really effective to ask people about what they are doing because people are, you know, they're least objective about themselves.
Yeah.
And so it was important that we're kind of assessing the unit of the team or the business unit that are working together, and that hence people are a lot more objective of what they see around them. And so when we've been able to sort of validate from like what people answer and through what we can observe, it is much closer when people are commenting on sort of what's happening as a team rather
yeah.
than on themselves. So that was an important factor on how we define those. We're also increasingly looking at like behavioral indicators of
mm-hmm.
these things. So, you know, can we look at how many prototypes a team runs of a certain type in a year? You know, unfortunately, the diversity of systems and the like mean that for now, like they're, you know, a lot of people will try to do this through measuring, you know, communication via email or a lot of
yeah.
these other factors. And we just don't think it's an accurate representation of the diversity of factors needed. And so we do go with a survey methodology where people are kind of commenting on the sort of the frequency of activities that are happening on their teams and
okay.
the methods that they're using.
So things that they can objectively count, then they can report back on those
exactly.
as some sort of a balancing metric.
Yeah.
That's great. And so how long, it's kind of a 10-minute survey that people are taking, reporting back on the quality.
It's
a
pretty meaty one. It's actually all, like about 20 minutes
uh-huh.
or so. It's 60 questions that kind of cover all of these topics. And because each of them have, you know, multi dimensions underneath that we want to get at.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, yeah.
And what are some of the most common problems? Like what's the, like in a small team, do you
yeah.
see any patterns about what's more commonly a problem, or are there general things across all?
It's pretty general. I mean, it's small teams are the most diverse, I'd say. Like
yeah.
they can spike kind of all over the place. bigger organizations, there's definitely some profiles. And I mean, purpose is highly variable. You know, some industries can almost borrow a purpose from their industry. They almost innately have a purpose, and others don't. But almost exclusively, things start to break down at looking out. At a sort of a large organizational level, this is something that is frequently sort of worked out of the system, and that there's very few system for people and teams to actually get outside inspiration, whether those are from consumers, markets, or technologies. So it's definitely frequently an initial focus area for a lot of organizations.
And I know we've seen that. I love one of the things you talked about, and so many companies we're seeing the entire organization adopting innovation and creativity methodologies. And that's everyone from legal to finance to HR to accounting. And I feel like that looking out trigger is right. The easiest way to step toward it once you get over that hurdle of just feeling uncomfortable leaving the safety of your desk.
And it has a splatter effect on everything else, right? Because it provides that sense of empathy. It gives people like that intuition to get started on ideas. It gives them some of even the uncertainty to sort of drive experimentation. And so, getting out there and looking out is so important to just kind of, you know, creating that initial like fuel and catalyst of the whole process. And I'd say even as you kind of mentioned for the internal facing teams, right, who their customer might be other employees at the company, that kind of silo busting that causes of like, oh, I'm designing solutions that, you know, these other people at my organization are going to use. And you know, many of them have never kind of gone out and actually talked to those other business functions or organizational functions.
I feel like that's a big pattern we see also is even if you're not a person in a position of power to implement this entire program, looking out can be such a small incremental step toward rallying people in a different direction by just saying, let's take a couple of hours and go and do this, or even three of us go and do this. And I think we see the passion that people come back with after doing a little bit of looking out.
Yeah. And it's just very, it's very convincing too, to just hear those stories, right? Because it's one thing to go kind of sit there and say, oh, I have an opinion about this, and this, you know, this new solution would be just so much better, to one say like, oh, you know, I talked to, you know, Frank and finance, and he's really struggling with this issue, and you know he has to do this and this and this in a day, and if we did this it would solve, and it'd be the story becomes so much more concrete and compelling when it's based in observation.
What about costs, budgets? And there's often a conception that to do things that are involving looking out and talking to customers, to do things that involve experimentation are more costly, and you need a bigger budget for those kinds of things, or more time. And so what do you see when teams are getting started down these paths, little loopholes to make progress?
Actually, I mean, often the truth is the opposite. We're actually a lot of the time we're burdening teams with processes and methods that actually kind of slow them down and kind of waste time on the wrong parts. And so if we can actually kind of shift that around, you actually create a much more healthier pipeline of experiments that is actually much more efficient and cost effective. And I mean, one story I love about this that kind of makes it concrete to me and just kind of shows sometimes how some of the simplest things can really save, you know, millions, tens of millions of dollars. We've been working with Michelin a couple years ago and we were doing a workshop with them, and they were kind of identifying and thinking about, you know, how do they get their, you know, lower fidelity prototyping up? And they're launching in some new categories. I believe in this one is a sport utility category that they were working on. And they kind of had this epiphany in it when they were kind of looking at their process, where it's like heavily R&D driven, a lot of investment in the development of a technology. And then they would kind of go out and evaluate these with customers and resellers and the like, and then they would figure out what has the most demand, and they would go and iterate it and come back. And they're like, actually, like we could go out with like a concept or a sales sheet of this stuff before doing all of the R&D, figure out how we want to play in this category, and then start investing in all of the R&D to do it. And with this method, and they've done it at least once now, and it's kind of changed their go-to-market for this, to my understanding. It's like, you know, they went from that what was always at minimum a 2-year cycle to launch into these new categories down to 8 or 9 months to launch in this new category. So, I mean, you know, I don't know exactly what that amounted to in terms of cost savings, but, you know, a more than 50% reduction in the time to market to enter a new category.
Yeah. And I think that little hook, that's such a creative design hook, though, that usually since our teams are so siloed, you see a team that has a concept, they want to race toward making it and creating it because that's the best way they can think of testing things. But I love that hook that you give us about how do you frame it up so in a way that looks a little bit more like marketing materials or a sales sheet,
yeah,
just to understand if that idea is even worthy or has value before investing in creation. And Absolutely. That's where you're saving lots of money, lots yeah. of time, rather than starting off building because you can.
Right.
I think we just see that all the time. A team gets attached to that one idea and they just race toward implementation.
Yeah,
and
like
it's
we
fun,
make X,
but
let's just yeah. make an X. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So my last question for you today is of all of these six qualities in creative difference, what's your team focusing on?
Yeah, I mean, so we're working on getting even more systematic about our testing and experimentation. So we've had to do a lot. We've been in the early stages where there was always like a big project to do it, but now that we are kind of getting in some of our tracks into more of an optimization mode, that's the moment where you can kind of get a little too sucked into the day-to-day. And so we're making it more systematic that like every week we've lined up, you know, 2 to 3 customers that we can talk to and evaluate, you know, how we're doing and how things are changing. And if we've got a new idea that we're about to launch, like prototype that and get them to experiment with it so that, you know, again, you want to get those like systems in place to do these things. So it's not just like, oh, I'll do it this week when I think I have a little bit of time. Rather, mm-hmm. you know, we want to make sure that we're getting that outside perspective like every week. So we're working yeah. on working that into our process.
Yeah. So it's so important when, even in those refinement stages when you could think it's all about optimization, how do you keep room for looking out, for experimentation, for constantly
100%.
Exploring?
Yep.
So thanks for joining us today. It's yeah. a pleasure to have you here. Thanks everyone for making the time to come and have this conversation with us. And we will see you again soon.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Creative Confidence from IDEO-U. Stay up to date on our Creative Confidence conversations and send your questions for our upcoming guests. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram and sign up for our IDEO-U newsletter at IDEO-U.com/CC. Thanks for joining us.